You're listening to the podcast, So You Want to Be a Writer, with Valerie Koo and Allison Tate. Valerie is an author, journalist, and national director of the Australian Writers' Centre, which is one of the world's leading providers of online and classroom courses for people who want to get published and write with confidence.
Allison Tate is a freelance writer, blogger, and author of the best-selling series The Mapmaker Chronicles. She has more than 20 years professional writing experience.
Each week they explore the world of writing, publishing and blogging to bring you news and opportunities, advice on how to succeed in the world of writing, interviews with top writers and much more. With students enrolling from all over the world, you can find out more about the Australian Writers' Centre at writerscentre.com.au.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 102 of So You Want to Be a Writer. My name's Valerie Koo and I'm here with Allison Tate. How are you, Al?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, Valerie, I'm covered in paint.
Why are you covered in paint? Have you changed careers and decided to become an artist?
Oh, no. And luckily for the whole world, I haven't done that because I am honestly the world's worst artist. No, the builder and I are in the process of painting the bedrooms.
Oh.
And I would just like to say that I wish that was a euphemism, but it is not. I am literally covered from head to foot in paint as we speak.
Are you painting it the same colour, like a fresh coat of paint?
Or no, no. We spent 6 months choosing.
Oh.
No, we don't do anything, you know, quickly when it comes. Everything's got to be thought about and discussed at length. So, no, we have the perfect white with the perfect trim, which, you know, is 1/4 strength of the perfect white.
Oh, yes.
But it took us 6 months to find the perfect white. It's been one of those long journeys.
Really?
And I've spent a fair bit of time, you know, while I've been cutting in because I'm really, you know, that's my favourite thing to do. Just thinking about how painting a bedroom is a little bit like editing a manuscript.
Oh.
And I know that I'm probably drawing a bit of a long bow here, but I did have a lot of time on my hands. But it's that whole thing of like you decide that this all happened because one of the boys needed a new wardrobe. And so the decision to get a new wardrobe was like, well, if we're going to move everything, you know, if we're going to have to change the wardrobe, why don't we use that as the impetus to actually paint the bedroom? And then we decided that if we were going to do one bedroom, we would do two bedrooms because as soon as you change one thing, everything must change to go with it, right?
Yes, that's true.
So we've pulled everything out of the rooms, and in the process of pulling everything out of the rooms, I have culled, honestly, like particularly out of Mr. Nine's bedroom. We've taken out two garbage bags full of cards, Woolies cards, Woolworths, a hex upon you, and then two bags to charity because he wasn't looking, so I was able to get some stuff out. So, you know, you edit, you're culling things as you go, and hopefully at the end of it, what you end up with is this fresh, sparkling, new, wonderful version of what you already had.
So is it starting to feel good? Like are you feeling decluttered and streamlined?
Well, No, I mean, I'm feeling decluttered. I felt really good about throwing stuff out. I've got to say, it's very cathartic,
yes,
particularly when you're throwing other people's stuff out.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
really good. Yes, I know, but I'm not at the point because we're still, you know, we had to undercoat, which of course then means you've got three layers, three coats of paint, big rooms, high ceilings. The builders spent, you know, most of the day lying on a scaffold painting the ceiling. It's like the Sistine Chapel in there, of course, but nonetheless.
Wow, this is what I've got to look forward to because I need to paint too.
I just reckon you should get someone to do it for you.
Okay, so this podcast is not actually House and Garden or Home Beautiful. I'll just let listeners know. It is about writing. It is You Want to Be a Writer. And we actually want to give a shout out to someone called, strangely, Boss's Death, who says, yes, I want to be a writer on iTunes and gave us a 5-star review.
Oh.
And Boss's Death has said, great podcast covering a huge range of writing-related topics, great reading recommendations and other interesting tidbits. The presenters have great chemistry and overall it feels like you're listening to a friend at a party talking about wonderful things you're interested in.
Oh.
Good job. Keep it up. I hope to be able to listen for another 100 episodes. Oh. Well,
I'm just hoping that you're thinking that painting is a wonderful thing because otherwise we've just spent 5 minutes boring Boss's Death to death. Anyway.
Thank you so much, Boss's Death. We really appreciate the review on iTunes. And if you do have 30 seconds to leave us a rating, a review on iTunes, we'd really appreciate it because it certainly helps us in the rankings.
It does.
So let's move on now to the world of writing and publishing and blogging this week. What do we have here? I think this is a link from you, Al. 65 online writing tools for writers, bloggers, and authors. Is that right?
It is. I actually think this probably should have been from you, but because it's your kind of thing. But look, it's basically just one to bookmark. It's an online, it's a list, as it says, 65 online tools. Mm. And it's just it's divided up into word processing, mind mapping and brainstorming, distraction blockers, session timers, ebook creation and publishing, editing, note taking, like all the things you could possibly think of. Mm. And it lists them in alphabetical order, which of course we love.
Yes.
So you can go through and have a look. It gives you the price of everything. Many of the apps and things that we've talked about on the program are actually on this list if you want to go through and have a quick look. Mm. But yeah, I mean, just having a quick scan through, I don't tend to use a lot of apps and online tools, but I know that you do, Valerie. Mm. So I'm not sure if there are any on there that you hadn't been aware of in the past, or is there anything new there for you that you've noticed?
There are certainly some there that I haven't used. There are many that I haven't used, but certainly some that I haven't heard of. So I might go through them and see if there's any that are going to take my fancy. We'll report back.
What a good idea. It can be a list for Valerie. We'll go through this and let you know if there's anything you should be worried about.
Yes. Fantastic.
And there's also a PDF. You can download the list and keep it, you know, attached to your computer if that's what you want.
Yeah, and we'll put the link in the show notes, which you can find at soyouwanttobeawriter.com.au.
Yes.
Now, moving on to an article that I read on Medium by Rob McTaggart, and we'll also put this link in the show notes for if you want to read the hot thing. It's called 13 Writing Habits That Are Making You Look Bad. And some of them are really straightforward and basic, like, you know, don't use text speak, like R-O-F-L, you know, see ya later, all that kind of stuff. But also a couple of things which some people maybe don't usually think of, and I do see a lot, and they are too many question marks and too many exclamation marks. It's pretty bad. It does make you look bad if you are using excessive exclamation marks, not just exclamation marks in a row, like, oh my God, can you believe that? Exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. That in itself does look very amateurish. But if you use even if you use a single exclamation mark, I often receive emails from people where the end of every sentence is an exclamation mark. And it's really not that exclamatory, you know what I mean?
They're probably just excited to be emailing you, Val.
Well, perhaps, but it's probably not the right thing to do if you have more exclamation marks than you have full stops in your email, which some people do. And I'm constantly editing people's work where I am deleting exclamation marks. So that is certainly one as well.
Well, here's one that I know that I'm guilty of,
yes,
particularly on social media, I think is probably my main forum for this particular problem, is ending my sentences with ellipses.
Oh.
I do love a dot, dot, dot.
Why, though?
I just love them. I don't know. They're just, it's so, you know, mysterious. Mm. I don't know. I'm not exactly sure. But if you have a look at my Facebook page, I realized the other day that I do have an actual serious problem. I may need an intervention, Val.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll let you know next time we see your dot, 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 your ellipses
exactly.
on social media.
Exactly.
So move on. This is just for you, Al, and I'm sure other people will be able to relate as well. Not so much for me, but this is from Psychology Today, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm.
And it's by someone called Linda Andrews, and the post is called "To Become a Better Writer, Be a Frequent Walker." Now,
There's nothing new here for us. We've had this conversation.
This is the advice that Alison gives all the time.
I know. Look at me.
Yes, because among past literary luminaries known to be avid walkers, so you're in great company, Al, were Charles Dickens, Virginia Woolf, Henry David Thoreau, William Wordsworth.
Look at me.
Yeah, look at you.
Wandering lonely as a cloud, just like William.
Exactly. Now, the thing is, a study from Stanford University showed that when people tackled mental tasks that required imagination, walking led to more creative thinking than sitting did. So you're walking and procrasti-pup making you go walk is definitely a good thing.
It's all, look, it's always been a thing. I've always been an advocate for active meditation, and I can now say that painting has a similar effect, although it is slightly more boring.
Okay, I think out of them I'd still prefer walking.
Me too.
But the interesting part is that, you know, because you go out with Procrasti Pup, right? And you go walking.
I do now, but I used to go on my own when I didn't have a dog.
Sure, but you went outside.
Always, yeah.
Yes, but sometimes people who live in rainy environments or, you know, where it's just not particularly attractive to go outside, it's not that enticing. So researchers compared walking outside to walking inside on a treadmill.
Oh.
Yeah. And they found that participants who walked, whether indoors or out, came up with more creative responses than those who, you know, sat inside.
Yeah. It's the movement. It's the actual movement. And it's that kind of like giving your brain over to your brain's, you know, focusing on staying upright, moving forward, doing all those things. And if you tuck that writing problem into the back of that of your mind, by the time you finished your walk, it somehow has managed to, you know, loosen whatever creative juice is required to get that thing done.
Yes. So don't sit there and stare at the computer screen if you're stuck.
No, get up.
Get up and go for that walk.
And let's go with riders with dogs. Let's have more of them.
Oh, yes, there's that as well.
Hashtag riders with dogs.
Now, you have a link for us about 10 things that make an editor stop reading your manuscript.
Yes. Now, I have no idea how I came across this. It's actually a link from July 16, 2014. Mm-hmm. It's on a blog by Elizabeth Law Reeds, and she's a editor and coach and, you know, consultant and all manner of things. But this is a really interesting piece about 10 things that will make an editor stop reading your manuscript. And it's basically is mostly aimed at children's YA manuscripts, but I do feel that a lot of the points are relevant whether, you know, no matter what you're writing. And I think the number one thing, and this is so important, and I've had several conversations about this very point lately, is that there is nothing at stake for the reader.
Oh, yeah.
There has to be, you know, the reader has to invest, and for the reader to invest, there has to be high stakes for your character. Mm. Even, you know, and high stakes don't necessarily mean, you know, a quest to the top of a mountain, but it's got to matter. Something important has to matter. The character has to have there's got to be a situation we can relate to. You know, there's got to be a kid who's having a problem. Like if you're writing a story, you know, people write a lot of funny books about kids, you know, having troubles with, in the sense that, you know, they've got lots to say about life, parents, school, crush, whatever, but there's got to be a problem. If there's no problem, there's no story. And this is something that when I do my school talks, I always talk about, you know, we talk about the three P's of storytelling if you're writing a story. And this is, you know, when I'm talking to grades 5 and 6. And those things are, to write a story, you've got to have three things. You have to have a person, character, you have to have a place, and you have to have a problem. If you don't have a problem, you don't have a story. And I think that's really important. And then a couple of the other things that really stood out to me too is that one of the things about writing for kids, I think, is that people get confused about the voice. They somehow feel like if they're writing for children, they have to write differently to how they would if they were writing anything else. So you end up with a voice that might be too young or it might be too old, you know, for the age of the child that you're writing about.
Yes.
And I think it's very important. You know, you don't want to sound cute. Kids don't want to read cute. When I write for kids, when I'm writing the Mapmaker Chronicles or something, I'm not actually consistently thinking about the fact that I'm writing for children. I have a sort of an end reader in my mind, but I don't actually write that much differently, if at all, to how I would if I was writing for adults. Obviously, it's a language choice and it's those sorts of things, but the voice is not that different. And I think it's important that you stay true to your voice and just think about your end reader. And the other thing I think that people often make the mistake of with particularly children's fiction is they're trying to teach a lesson every time they write something. Mm. And I think Elizabeth makes a very good point, and she says that, you know, in fiction your job is to tell a story. And that's the main focus of what you're doing. It's not necessarily a moral lesson or educational value that a kid is going to pick your book up for. If they get that as a byproduct, awesome. But it shouldn't be the focus of the actual.
Well, no one likes to be told what to think. They'd like to come to their own conclusion.
They like to come to their own conclusion.
Yeah,
that's right.
Kids.
Yeah.
And also I like the one because I see this annoys me. Number 7, which is making up convenient rules for your world that appear as the story progresses. And that is very frustrating as a reader, or even if you're watching a movie when, you know, you're invested in this journey and suddenly very conveniently a new rule comes about or something happens in the story that makes them go in another direction that really just wasn't realistic.
It's just that it wasn't working for you the other way and you needed to have a change of direction.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. A really good one. Well, we'll put that link in the show notes as well. So our giveaway for this week, Al, yes, it is something a bit different. It's called They All Love Jack Busting the Ripper. Can you guess who that might be about?
Jack the Ripper?
Yes. So it's by Bruce Robinson, and he's done an investigation, obviously, into one of history's most notorious killers, and he has collated 15 years, imagine researching this for 15 years, goodness me, of research into the serial murders of Jack the Ripper in 1880s London. And as it says here, presents a rather compelling conspiracy theory turning the entire events of what took place upside down. So it's something that will make Jack the Ripper enthusiasts, I wouldn't say fans, or people who are fascinated by Jack the Ripper or fascinated by true crime, this certainly would be an interesting book. And if you want to win, then just go to writerscentre.com.au/win. And entries close Monday the 4th of April. But if you're listening to this podcast in the future, don't worry. Just go to writerscentre.com.au/win and you'll find something else that we're giving away.
This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre, a world leader in writing courses. Our popular 5-week online course in copywriting essentials will teach you how to turn your writing skills into a weapon of mass persuasion. Learn the 7 steps to creating compelling copy, how to take a creative brief, the secrets of SEO, and much more, so you can begin earning good money immediately. Learn online from wherever you are and get your own tutor providing personalised feedback on your writing. To find out more, visit writerscentre.com.au/essentials.
All right, shall we move on to something quite different now?
Let's.
You might remember that last week I was obsessed with a word.
Yes.
And it was synecdoche.
That's right. And we all thought it was synodoc, but we were wrong.
I have a new one.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to spell it. So C-O- P-A-C-E-T-I-C. What do you think?
Well, you could go a few ways with this. I don't know what the root of this particular word is, but you could go copacetic, or you could go copacetic, or you could go copacetic. So I'm sure you're going to tell me because otherwise why would we be having this conversation?
I'm not certain. However, I hear it often as copacetic. And that sort of makes sense to me. But anyway, copacetic, so this is this week's obsession and I'm using it all over the place. My partner thinks I've gone crazy. So I'm sitting in the car and saying, everything's copacetic, don't worry. Because basically copacetic means everything's fine or everything's excellent. It means, fine or excellent. But, you know, you kind of do think, well, why don't you, as my partner says, well, why don't you just say fine? But, you know, this is my word of the week. So I'm using copacetic everywhere. So just thought I'd share that.
Just dropping that into the conversation. Are you just casually throwing that in?
Everything's copacetic.
And everyone looks at you and goes, what?
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, I might have a different – who knows, I might be obsessed with a different word next week.
We can only hope. Maybe you'd like to be obsessed with fine next week.
Okay.
I'm all for plain speaking, Val, you know that.
Let's move on to – you have a interesting blog for us to look at.
I do. Speaking of plain speaking, I would like to say thank you very much to Amy Clark, who sent us the who sent me the recommendation for this blog. You might remember a few episodes ago, we recommended Maria Vicente's blog. She's an agent from, I think, Canada, and it's a terrific blog. Well, Amy suggested that we might also enjoy Carly Waters blog because she is also a literary agent. Now it's Carly Waters, waters.com. Mm-hmm. We'll put the link in the show notes. But it's a great research. She talks a lot. I mean, she obviously knows what she's talking about. But she also does a terrific series called Things I Wish I Knew, where she has kind of guest posters, interviews and things like that, people talking about things they know about and things they wish they'd known about before. So she's got the Book Barista's Tips for Social Media. She's got tips on navigating publishing contracts. She's got, you know, authors talking about things that they wish they'd known when they were starting out. And she it's a fairly deep well of resource here. There's an awful lot of stuff here for, you know, to go through. In fact, you know, I could spend a fair bit of time probably just wading through that. And she also has she has a book called Getting Published in the 21st Century, Advice from a Literary Agent. So I suggest, you know, that if getting published in the 21st century is something you're interested in, then definitely have a look at Carly's blog. And thank you very much to Amy for that recommendation.
Fantastic. And we'll put the link in the show notes. But if you want to go to it, it is Carly, Carly Waters, waters.com. Now let's move on to our writer in residence this week.
Ooh, I love it. I feel like we should have a drum roll for this.
Drum roll. Well, way back in like 1992 or possibly 93, you know, long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Dark ages, much, much younger.
I did work experience at a magazine called Looks Magazine, which is now defunct, but it was basically like a, you know, teenage girls magazine. And it was down in Rushcutters Bay, I remember, at this publisher's called Gore and Osmond. And around the corner, just down, just across the corridor, was this very glamorous lady who used to sit in that office. And she was the editor of a magazine at the time called Portfolio, which was very groundbreaking at the time. It was a magazine for business women. It's kind of normal now, but back then there wasn't anything like it. And I used to think, oh, wow, how glamorous, a, you know, magazine for business women. And she used to waltz in and out. She was really, she was quite glamorous. And that lady was Alexandra Joel. And she subsequently, you know, became, well, I don't know subsequently, but she has been an editor of the Australian edition of Harper's Bazaar as well, and has became a journalist and contributed to many publications, of the major publications. Released a book called Parade, The Story of Fashion in Australia, and subsequently became a psychotherapist in another career.
Wow.
But more recently, she delved into her own life, the life of her great-grandmother, who is named Rosetta, and discovered that she, you know, she had a respectable husband and a five-year-old in Melbourne, but she ran away with Zeno the Magnificent. Yes.
Really?
A half-Chinese fortune teller, and they ran away to Europe and basically hung out with famous writers and inventors and scientists and dukes and duchesses and all of that sort of stuff, and lived this whole other life. So what Alexandra subsequently did was wrote effectively a story about Rosetta, but, you know, in it she discovered a lot about her own life. So that is who we are talking to today. So thank you for joining us today, Alexandra.
Thanks so much.
Now, let's just start with, for those who haven't read your book yet, Rosetta, can you tell us what it's about?
Rosetta is the story of my scandalous great-grandmother, who was the family, not just a secret, but a mystery. I knew nothing about her when I grew up, neither did my mother. Neither really did my grandmother. Rosetta lived in Melbourne at the turn of the century, and if you could imagine her, she was the granddaughter of a convict made good, very respectable, married to a respectable gentleman. She had a five-year-old daughter, and then she met a man called Zeno the Magnificent, and she ran away with him.
Goodness. He must have charmed her.
He was a fortune teller, and he read her palm. The building in which he read her palm is still there today in Swanston Street in Melbourne. I have stood in the street and looked at it just around the corner from Chinatown, because what I haven't said is that Zeno was in fact half Chinese. His father was what they called a goldfield celestial. So when she ran away with him, not only was it enormously shocking because she had left her husband, she had left her child, but she'd run away with a man who was Chinese. Mm-hmm. And that, in Edwardian Melbourne, was seen as beyond the pale.
Wow. So when did you discover this? How did you discover this if your mother didn't really know much about it and your grandmother didn't really know much about it?
Well, I guess in order to tell you that, what I have to tell you is that Zeno and Rosetta completely reinvented themselves. Mm-hmm. He said he was a Japanese professor of medicine. Hmm. She said she was American. They set off for the UK. He set up rooms. He became the toast of the town. He became the go-to doctor with absolutely no training whatsoever. Mm-hmm. He did everything from prescribed medicine, which he also created in his own laboratory, laid hands, told fortunes, had seances. They became the toast of the town. They became extraordinarily well connected with duchesses and dukes and princesses. But she never saw her child again. And that child was my grandmother.
Wow.
And all I heard when I grew up from my grandmother was, my mother didn't want me. Oh. She ran away and left me. So it was a terrible thing. It affected her deeply, as you would imagine. Mm. It affected my mother, her daughter, and it affected me. But after, we never asked. She didn't know anything. There was no point going there. But when my grandmother died, my parents got the death certificate. And there on the death certificate was the name Rosetta. And my father decided, my father was an old journalist from the 20s and the 30s. He said, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. Who was she? And that's what began the story. That's what began the search.
Yes. So your father first started the search and then you decided to turn it into a book. How did the idea for the book, you know, come about?
Well, he became immersed in this extraordinary story because all of these incredible details started to emerge that, of course, nobody had any idea about. This glamorous, exciting life of adventure that they had romping their way across Europe with various royals and members of the aristocracy. He was, as you could imagine, extremely engaged. And one day he came into my room. I remember he was sort of waving these documents. And he said, Al, which is what he called me for short, Al, your great-grandmother's story was incredible. There's a book here. You must write it.
Wow.
And that was a long time ago. That was back in the 90s.
Really?
I was involved with it. You know, I was editing magazines. I was writing other things. I was training. I had, you know, was to bring up a family. All of these things sort of happened, but the story wouldn't go away. Mm. And I knew no matter what he discovered, I had a feeling there was more to it, that there was even more than he knew about. Mm. And I guess one day the stars aligned and I thought, I think also being a parent yourself and looking back, you become conscious of what's gone before. And on the one hand, her story was this amazingly wonderful, glamorous story about an independent woman who took the world on, who wouldn't take no for an answer, that was willing to break every taboo and every convention. But on the other hand, very dark thread ran through it.
Mm. So when did you take those papers out of the drawer? When did the stars align and make you think, okay, now's the time?
Well, it's a really good question because although I started writing a couple of years ago, it took ages actually before I could do it. And the reason was I felt torn. I think I felt almost a sense of perhaps disloyalty to my grandmother, the child she'd left behind. And I felt very torn because half of me was completely fascinated by this, you know, incredible woman, this amazing, unconventional, glamorous woman who, you know, on first name terms with Empress Eugenie and, you know, the Duchess of Rutland and so forth. On the other hand, I was appalled. And the other half felt, what sort of a monster leaves their five-year-old daughter and never sees her again? And I found it terribly hard to reconcile these two things. And that's what held me up until one day everything fell into place.
And what fell into place?
I realized I had to stop. I guess I had to stand outside that family focus and draw on my training, because although I'd had one career as a journalist and editor, I went on to retrain as a psychotherapist, and I conducted a psychotherapy practice for a decade. And I thought, okay, the only way to do this is to leave all judgment behind and just get to know this extraordinary woman and try and understand what motivated her, try and understand what it meant to be Rosetta in Edwardian Melbourne, what it meant to be married off at 18 to a much older man, what it meant to be a brilliant, daring, beautiful woman who wanted more, and to try and understand what it could have been like for her. I'm not sure if I think I still, and when you, you know, in reading the book, I think you can see I still struggle with that, and I was very honest with the reader. One part of me was understanding how trapped she felt and what she wanted in her life and what it was like to meet a man who said, you can be whoever you want to be. But the other part of me was still struggling, and I guess continues to, with how does a woman do that?
How did you, like, she went to the other side of the world, basically. How did you go about researching what went on and recreating that life? What were the key things that you did to do that?
Well, first of all, I was quite lucky because my father had, and this is many years ago, this is back in the late 80s and early 90s, he had tracked down several people that knew her and interviewed them, and he left transcripts behind. So I had those transcripts, which were really valuable, mainly because most of those people have now passed away. I had an extraordinary collection of letters that were written by Europe's great and good. I did a lot of reading. I spent a lot of time on the internet, and I went to the places that she went to. I went to all the places she lived in Melbourne, the places she was in Sydney. I went over to the UK, and I also went to the south of France. And that was probably the most exciting of all.
And so did this become a full-time project for you, or did you do this while you were doing other things?
No. That's a very good question too. No, I was actually like a woman possessed. And I think that's part of the stars aligning, because, you know, my kids had become adults. I had recently closed my psychotherapy practice. You know, a whole number of things that I'd been working on had finished up, and I thought, this is the time I'm going to do it. And the story became so engrossing and also so complex, because at the same time as following her life, I was following what was happening in my grandmother's and my mother's life to make sense of it all. I had to work for long periods of time. So literally, I would get up in the morning, I would have breakfast, and I'd go to my computer, and frankly, I couldn't wait. Half the time I was still in my pajamas at lunchtime. I thought she was on my shoulder. It was honestly, when I tried to imagine what it would be like to be Rosetta, to know those people, to be in those places, it was as if a movie was kind of running in my head. And because I was dying to know what was happening next, I had to write it down.
Mm. Wow.
It's sort of like, in order to read the book, I had to write it.
Yes. I love that. So you'd wake up, you'd go to your computer, sometimes lose track of time, you might be in your pajamas still in the middle of the day. Tell us then about, did you have a routine where you did certain things in the morning or wrote certain things in the morning and did research in the afternoon? Or did you have any kind, while you were writing this, did you have follow any kind of structure or aim for a certain word count or anything like that?
It wasn't word count that I was aiming for, but I did have the shape of her life. I did have a chapter. I did have a chapter outline which got dramatically jumbled up by the end, as these things do. Mm. But I had a diary, and I would write in my diary, this is the week I'm going to write about this section or this scene. You know, I'm going to write about Wonderland City, or I'm going to write about meeting Empress Eugenie in the south of France, or, you know, one of her adventures. But I would actually diarize it in non-electronic diary, but in a real life diary, and I would pin it up and say I might allow a week for that or a fortnight for it. But if I got to the end of that fortnight and I hadn't finished, I would just sort of have notes, but I would move on.
I
wouldn't stay endless, you know, sort of perfecting it and rounding it out. And so I just get it down, because for me it was really important to get the whole shape of the book, you know, to get the whole story. That's what I mean. It's just, it was this compulsion that, look, I can't spend any more time about this bit because I want to know what happens next. And, of course, the great thing with writing is, you know, you can always go back. I knew I could go back. I knew I could build on it. I knew I could, I don't know, improve the writing. I knew I could add bits in. But I had to get that narrative down.
Wow. So you mentioned that you have a background in journalism, and I certainly remember 22, 23 years ago, I did work experience in the offices of Gore and Osmond and in Boundary Street in Rushcutters Bay. And yes, does that take you back? And I believe time you were the editor of Portfolio.
That's right.
And which was one of the first magazines for working women.
It was a pioneering magazine in Australia.
It was. And I loved it. And when did you decide you wanted to become a journalist? Just take us back to when, you know, that you decided on that first career.
Well, I'd always been interested. I guess, you know, my dad had kind of grown up on the papers. I mean, you know, he was a copy boy at the age of 14. He literally grew up on the papers. But he always said to me, don't be a journalist. You know, it's no place for a woman. Don't be a journalist. And I went to university, and in those days there was no such thing as media and communications courses. So I did an honours degree in government. But I specialised in media, but it was in the political aspects of media. That was sort of as close as I felt I could get. So I started to work more on the government legislative side of media, because things like FM radio were very new then, and there were all sorts of television initiatives happening. And it just kept nagging away at me, and I been a part of a group that was applying for an FM radio license, and I did that. And then I kind of thought, you know, this is really not satisfying me. I want to write. And so I just looked at a range of magazines. In those days, Australian Consolidated Press, which was owned by Mr. Packer, was the big thing, but also Fairfax had a very strong magazine group. And, I mean, must be where fools, you know, fools rush in, but I just started to write and I started to submit. And I found my work was accepted. I never forget, oh, God, you know, that feeling when you have your first check and you want to frame it and you want to stop people in the street. But I was actually too inhibited. And because I was doing this sort of government work, I didn't want people to know that I was doing it. So for years I wrote under another name. So I kept on doing, you know, the other work, and I was also working in a family company which had media interests, but not as a journalist, as an executive. And I kept contributing to all these magazines. In the end, then I wrote a book. I wrote a book which was on the history of fashion in Australia, which was a social history really told through dress and identity. And by that time, I'd been writing a lot for Harper's Bazaar, probably one, two, three big pieces each issue. And when Fairfax kind of collapsed and Consolidated Press bought the Fairfax magazines, they asked me to edit Harper's Bazaar, which was terrific. So I did that. And from there I went on and edited Portfolio. Then I did another book. And about then I decided to have a change in career.
Was Portfolio around before you were editing it?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was around for a number of years before I took the chair. And at the time it was, I mean, it was pretty revolutionary because
there was nothing like it at all.
There was nothing like it. And the fact is that mainstream media, business pages, business magazines did not give any profile to working women, didn't deal with any issues that might pertain to working women, didn't offer a platform to working women. I mean, it sounds extraordinary now because I like to think that, in a sense, Portfolio did such a good job that there was no longer a need for a magazine like that. And maybe today people think, oh, that's kind of quaint. But in those days, women didn't have a voice.
Yes.
And they really needed one. And this was a means to give it to them.
So you then, obviously you have this background in journalism, you can write, but writing articles is very different to writing a book. And, you know, there's much more instant gratification with writing articles, sort of, because it's much shorter. You don't have, it doesn't take you 2 years to write an article or whatever. What did you need to change in your approach to writing in order to sustain the period it would take to write this much, much longer story?
There were two things I did. Because I wasn't terribly confident and I thought I might be kind of lonely, you know, locked away in my little room, I joined a writing course on memoir and creative nonfiction, and that was great because that gave me a writing cohort. It did give me a group of people to see each week and to check in with over a period of 2 or 3 months. That was a big help. And but really, more than that, I know it sounds crazy, but I was just dying to read this book. And I had a friend, a very good friend that I've had for many, many years, and I kind of felt like we were sharing it together. Like I was dying to. It was sort of like a book group of two. I was dying to read it, and so was she. So it was a bit like, you know, the way Dickens would sort of write a chapter, not that I'm comparing myself to Dickens, but he would write a chapter and it would be published every couple of weeks, and then he'd write another chapter and it would be published. Well, that's what it was like with my friend. And sometimes I'd literally give a hard copy, sometimes I'd email it to her and say, here's the next bit, here's the next instalment. And it was gorgeous to have an audience.
Yes.
It was gorgeous to write for somebody. And it was also probably really good to have another voice saying, come on, I'm dying to know what happens. What did she do?
So if you became a woman possessed and obsessed in this period, now that it's written, it's out there, do you find yourself twiddling your thumbs and kind of going, well, what do I research now? Well, what am I working on now?
Oh, no, not at all, because this book has had such a quick turnaround. I only signed with Random House in September, and I hadn't actually even finished because I still had a chapter missing where I had to say, look, I've got this bit that I really is important that I've got to do. The only problem is I've got to go to the Riviera.
Yeah.
Sounds like such an improbable line. So they kind of did a half edit, and I responded to that, and then I beetled over and went to these amazing villa and places I needed to go to, came back, wrote that, then they did the other half edit, and so it was sort of went into production really quickly. So I didn't have much time to really think, but I think I've got the bug, Valerie, because I've already come across another extraordinary story, which is also about a family secret and a family mystery.
Your family secret?
No. this is actually a whole other family.
Right.
And partly because of that, this book is going to be a novel, although very much based on the true extraordinary story. And I can't wait now to get going on this one.
Wow. Okay. Is this one going to take you to the Riviera or somewhere a bit more, even more exotic?
Well, this one will take me from the far west New South Wales to Paris.
Wow, it's a hard life, isn't it?
I know.
The things you need to do in the name of research. Okay, so have you already started working on that?
I have. I haven't put pen to paper, but I have started the interviewing process and the collecting of material. And yet again, it is a story about a family. It also has a fair component of glamour and desire, but it too has a very dark thread that runs through it. And I guess maybe that shows two halves of my life. One is editor of Harper's Bazaar, and the other is really down in the trenches as a psychotherapist, because, you know, behind the beauty, behind the adventure, there is very often a very dark and sometimes bitter tale as well.
Sounds like you really enjoy telling that tale.
I do.
All right, and on that note then, thank you so much for your time today, Alexandra.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Valerie.
There you go, Alexandra Joel.
What a fascinating story. Wouldn't it be fabulous to like find that in your own family tree?
I know. I mean, you have a book ready and waiting to happen, right?
Amazing. Yep, you do. You do.
I don't have such an exciting life.
Really? Are you sure?
I'm pretty
have
sure.
Have you delved? No Zeno in your life somewhere?
No,
in your tree?
Maybe. I should delve.
My father has delved so far in all directions, including my husband's family, all the in-laws, everybody, and I don't think he's turned up anything as interesting as Zeno the Magnificent. So I'm going to tell him to try harder.
Yeah.
Because clearly he's researching my next book for me.
You'll have to make it up.
He will, definitely.
Okay, so we have a working writer's tip, which is inspired by a question from Sarah. So Sarah asks, I lived in Sweden for many years, but recently moved back to Australia. Since moving back, I've started to write a novel, which I, for some reason, found difficult to do when overseas. However, my family and I are now considering moving back to Sweden, and I'm concerned that if I am no longer immersed in English, it might affect my writing there. Do you think living in a country with a foreign language can be problematic for writers who write in English? Also, I wonder if it would be difficult to publish a manuscript in Australia if I'm living overseas. So there's two questions there. You can pick whichever one you wanna answer first. Al?
Oh, I wish you would give me some warning about these things. Okay, so I'm going to start with part A because I've never actually lived, I mean, I have lived overseas, but I never immersed myself in a foreign language on any level. So I can't really answer that as to whether or not it would be difficult. Have you ever been in that circumstance, Val?
While I didn't live there, you know, full time, I lived there full time for only, I guess, months in Cambodia when I was doing some work there. And the thing is, while I was there, even though I was learning Cambodian and I was doing work in Cambodian, I was immersing myself in a whole other very different language, I actually freelanced for Australian publications. So I always had that connection. So, and I was always in, writing a story for the Sydney Morning Herald or whoever. And so I think you can have both of those things. You can actually live in one country and be immersed in another language and still have that connection with your mother tongue. Absolutely. I mean, of course, interestingly, there's that recent book that won that prize by Chumpa Lahiri, who she wrote the language.
In Italian that she'd learned. I remember her.
That's right. Even though her mother tongue is Bengali and she lives in America. Lives in America, mother tongue is Bengali, wrote in Italian, and it just won like the Booker or something, you know. I think she is certainly evidence that you can do those things for sure. But what about the question of, I wonder if it would be difficult to publish a manuscript in Australia if I'm living overseas?
Given how connected the world is now, I don't see it as any problem. I have friends who publish in the US and they live in Australia and publish in the UK and they live in Australia. So I see no reason why it wouldn't go the other way. I think it's a matter of, you know, submitting to Australian publishers in the same way that people who live in Australia do. Whether you do that via an Australian agent or not is up to you. I have found friends have said to me that if you want to submit in the US, you need a US agent. It's one of those situations. I think that it's a matter of doing your research. And the other thing that you, of course, need to do is think about, you know, building your author platform. And you've still got those links to Australia, though. So the fact that you're actually living in Sweden, you've got lots to blog about there, is all I can say. You know, you've got a way of actually creating quite an interesting community around yourself because you're an Australian living in Sweden. And, so I think as long as you keep up your networks and your connections with Australia, I don't see why it would be any more difficult than if you were living in Melbourne.
Yes, I agree 100%. The world is so connected now, and I think you've hit the nail on the head, Al. As long as you keep your networks alive and connected, then it shouldn't make any difference. The thing that does make a difference is if, for example, you go to Sweden and you do not build your author platform at all in Australia, so you have no following in Australia, no connection to Australia, and don't intend to build one. However, if you go to Sweden and still maintain those connections and still make sure you build your author platform within an Australian community, if that is where you want to be selling, then that's just going to work in your favour. So there you go. That's an interesting question.
Really interesting question. Yes. Thanks very much for that, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah. So before we wrap up, Al, what are you up to this week?
Well, apart from painting, I'm hoping at some point there will be no paint under my fingernails. What am I up to? Working on a course, editing a novel, waiting. I'm still waiting. You know, everybody, how much I love waiting. Well, I'm waiting. So that's what I'm doing. So I'm keeping myself busy and amused while I wait because that is the best thing to do.
Sounds good.
Yeah. What about you?
What about me? I've got a little bit of travel coming up, but what's been interesting. You know how I've been talking over some of the previous episodes about I'm really seeing this rise in content marketing and and branded journalism. So basically where companies are becoming publishers.
Yep.
You know, where they and where freelance writers are getting heaps more opportunities, not just in the world of magazines, but where they are being commissioned by companies to write articles, whether that's on health or travel or business or whatever. Well, that certainly hit me this week, because in 48 hours, this was last week actually, within a space of 48 hours, three major companies had approached me, you know, there was this email in my inbox to write for them. And what's interesting is they are offering much higher rates than regular editorial. So it's certainly a trend that I am seeing, and certainly one that I think is going to continue. So it's a great opportunity for freelance writers, especially if you have a grounding in magazine and newspaper writing.
Definitely. You need to know what you're doing.
Yes, definitely, definitely, because then you'll just get repeat work. All right, so where do we find you online, Al?
You will find me on Facebook at Alison Tate Writer. You will find me on Twitter at Al Tate. And you will find me at alisontate.com. And I am Instagramming, and there have been photos of paint pots and Procrasty Pup. You know, it's all happening on Instagram. But, yeah, so that's where you'll find me. What about you?
You'll find me at Valerie Koo on Twitter and Instagram. Just search for Valerie Koo on Facebook. Pretty easy to find. I've been mucking around with the Snapchat.
How's it going for you?
The real Valerie Koo. Koo.
Are you the Valerie Koo or the real Valerie
Just
Koo?
Just the Valerie Koo. Valerie Koo is taken, what can I say, by millennial, no doubt. It's fun. I'm just mucking around on Snapchat, but it's fun. You know, I'm some days I'm really active, sometimes I'm not. So, hey, hit me up on Snapchat. Thank you for those people who have and have been sending me messages on Snapchat as well. It's really fun. All right. So until we chat again, everyone, thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to So You Want to Be a Writer. You'll find the show notes at writerscentre.com.au/podcast, or sign up for our awesome and often hilarious weekly newsletter at writerscentre.com.au/news, where you'll find writing resources, giveaways, competitions, and much more.